Good afternoon and welcome to On Point Veterans Talk Radio here at 89.9 FM, your local voice for North Central Montana and Great Falls. And I'd like to thank everybody in the community and all our KGPR volunteers who helped during the pledge drive, especially our donors and to our fantastic underwriters out there. I'm not going to name them all, but you can go to our website, kgpr.org, and see our underwriters. They provide us the ammunition and the supplies and all the things we need on this ship of KGPR, or our army. And here in the studio today is Ken Robison, our acclaimed historian. I like to say that, Ken, and retired U.S. Navy captain. And we're going to see each other on Veterans Day, right?
Yes, we are. We're going to ask for a sunny, warm afternoon.
Oh, okay.
And we'll get a cold, nasty one.
Yes, well.
So we'll be in Centene instead.
Well, we could be in the Centene lobby, or maybe, Lord willing, we may be up at the memorial. We've done a lot of work up there, new flagpoles and concrete work. I'm not going to steal the thunder from Star Darko, but there'll be a lot to see whether we're on site or down in the lobby.
Absolutely, and it's nothing nicer up at the memorial for the memorial events like Veterans Day and Memorial Day and so on.
And you've been a few times. Last year you were talking about Too Many Unknown Soldier, I think, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, and that was I'm trying to remember John Ranum, a good friend of mine. He was a Sentinel, 1961. We've had him on the air with On Point also. And we're going to have a few other guests besides yourself. You're going to be talking about Montana veterans in the Cold War, right?
You bet.
And we'll come back to that in a moment. And we're going to have Colonel Barry Little, the new commander of Malmstrom Air Force Base, 341st Missile Wing. He took command last July, I think. We're going to have a salute to Private Durrell Gibbs, 97-year-old World War II combat veteran from Okinawa, 96th Infantry Division. His son Wes wrote a narrative about his dad called A Soldier Story, and hopefully, God willing, and the weather allows, Wes and his dad will be on site with us. So that's going to be a great thing.
Very special.
And then we'll have Jesse Callender, who always does the bagpipes. That's a standing invitation. And this year, we're going to have Sound of the Falls, the Women's Harmony Chorus. They like to call themselves a chorus. They'll be doing the national anthem, and then they got a patriotic song medley set up. And we'll reveal that when our TAF gets up to the podium as our distinguished MC.
Oh, he's fantastic.
Yeah, Art does a great job. But he's a Navy man too, Ken.
Yeah, exactly.
You heard him what he said about officers, right?
Tell us.
He'll probably tell it again.
Okay. Well,
yeah, but
we'll
leave it to him. Enlisted public affairs guy. I'm just going to go over a couple more things we're going to have at the benediction will be provided by Chaplain Jeremy Jarvis from Malmstrom Chaplain's Office, and also we'll have benediction from Bishop Lori Jungling, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. And I'm working to get a Great Falls High trumpet player because I like to bring the youth in there.
We had a good one last year.
Oh, yeah. And they're stepping up to the plate and doing it. And that's what they should be doing. So, and the Air Force Junior RTC cadets will be there helping do the Pledge of Allegiance.
Great.
So I think that's what we got lined up. And the Honor Guard is there all the time. Our Malmstrom Honor Guard, so we're happy to have all that, and we'll have a great gathering to remember our traditions and honor our veterans. So, let's go back to Cold War Montana. So, how's the book doing?
Book's doing great. I'm going over to Missoula this Friday to talk about it, and and actually going back to Missoula the week after that to talk about it again, so I stay busy with it, but this is a good time. The month of October, 60 years after that crucial Cuban Missile Crisis that probably everybody that old enough to have lived through it remembers those days very, very carefully. 60 years ago this month, the world teetered on the brink of catastrophic nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union until leadership and luck prevailed. That was the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962, and it brought the United States-Soviet Union to that point where there was great concern, and So for almost a month between 16th of October and 20th of November, this was a potential very hot war. 1 year later, in September of 1963, just weeks after, before his assassination, President John F. Kennedy came to Montana first. He spoke in Billings and the following day here in Great Falls. And both of those speeches were part of an 11-state tour he was making of the West to talk about his natural resources program and to sort of kind of beat up on the Republicans for not supporting the program in Congress that he wanted to get through. Well, he tossed all those speeches out when he was here in Montana, and especially in Great Falls. President John F. Kennedy gave one of the most memorable speeches of the Cold War, and it was partly a tribute to his powerful majority leader, Mike Mansfield, because before he went to Great Falls High School Memorial Stadium, he stopped by the Mansfield home, the longtime home on the Lower South Side, and visited that home, and Mike Mansfield was there at where he was raised in Great Falls. And
his mom and dad, right?
And then, no, it was, actually it was uncle and, and anyway, it was, his dad was in New York and he had kind of abandoned him. It was a really rough childhood. And, you know, the whole story of Mike Mansfield would be a good one to tell sometime when we get together.
Well, because, and he was in all three services, right?
I mean, he as a extremely young, some say 14, at least 15-year-old, he went into World War One and wound up over the next couple of years serving in all three branches of the service. And but anyway, President Kennedy and his entourage stopped by the Mansfield home and then went on to Memorial Stadium, where there were over 20,000 gathered, packed into that famous football field. But it that day was the venue for the big crowd. And what President Kennedy said a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis was, Montana's a long way from Washington, and it's a long way from the Soviet Union, and it's 10,000 miles from Laos. But this particular state, Montana, because it has, among other reasons, concentrated within its borders some of the most powerful nuclear missile systems in the world, must be conscious of every danger and must be conscious of how close Montana lives to the firing line which divides the communist world. We're many thousand miles from the Soviet Union, but this state, to a very real sense, is only 30 minutes away. Now, those are powerful words and spoken from the heart by President Kennedy.
Did he visit any silos or facilities when he was
here? No, it was come and go, as most presidential tours.
Right, yeah, of course.
You don't take the whole afternoon to stroll around Malmstrom and onto a missile site. And, you know, the Launch Control Center for Alpha 1, which is
the ace in the hole.
Which was the ace in the hole, was, you know, 25 or so miles east of Great Falls. So it would have been a real commitment of time. So they didn't do that.
So,
but let's return now to October 1962, the time of the crisis and the dangers that were unfolding through a background of escalating tensions in the Cold War, fueled by the failed Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, followed 6 weeks later in the summer of 1861 by a summit in Vienna for President Kennedy and Soviet First Secretary Nikita Khrushchev, at which the latter concluded that President Kennedy, the newly elected American president, was very inexperienced and even immature and a weak leader. 2 months after the summit, the Soviets and East Germans erected the Berlin Wall in direct response to how they had read the president's weakness in Vienna. Yet President Khrushchev misjudged the inexperienced president. Kennedy was a quick study, and he learned from his performance in Vienna, but the Soviet Union and Khrushchev did not know that. And at the very time this was all happening, the U.S. was deploying medium-range missiles, the Jupiter, to Italy and Turkey. And that had the Soviet Union very, very concerned. And also, the Soviet Union was receiving a very strong appeal from Fidel Castro that they bring weapons into Cuba, site them in Cuba in case of another invasion by the U.S., sponsored invasion by the U.S. And so during the summer, the Soviets in secrecy had begun constructing both medium-range missile bases for their SS-4s and 5s, but also moving bombers in, nuclear-capable bombers. President Kennedy was briefed, and as the fall campaign was underway with charges by some that he was ignoring what was clearly building up to be a Soviet presence in Cuba, the U.S. military started a reconnaissance effort that yielded U-2 photography that clearly showed the SS-4 and 5 medium-range ballistic missile sites under construction in Cuba. With that clear photographic evidence, President Kennedy and his defense team concluded that they had to take action and had to find a way to get the Soviets to withdraw from Cuba. So in a dramatic primetime television address to the world in October, President Kennedy announced the discovery of the Soviet offensive missiles and aircraft in Cuba, and he said, "It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missiles launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response from the Soviet Union." The president declared that the U.S. would not permit those Soviet offensive weapons to remain in Cuba, and he demanded that those weapons already there be dismantled and shipped back to the Soviet Union. And, of course, he had advice ranging from taking those sites out with air and naval attacks, and he sort of put together a program that was effective in the long run, but it was not as provocative as a direct attack against those missile sites and those Soviet forces that were in Cuba.
And I got a question. Where were you at this time?
I was under a pineapple patch in northern Oahu in Hawaii.
What?
And I was serving at the time at what was called the Fleet Operations Control Center in northern Oahu. And we were the host command for an underground relocation center for the Commander Pacific and the component commands in wartime or in exercises, or in this case, in the Cuban Missile Crisis. They'd all relocate to that underground location and put on their war footing. And so it was, although we were half the world away from Cuba, we were certainly directly involved in the sense of having all the Pacific commands located with us there at that Fleet Operations Control
Center.
Were you
a lieutenant then?
I was a lieutenant then, yeah.
So not too long in uniform, but exciting time, and you all going alert.
It was a very exciting time, for sure.
Well, what I like about your book is you have these blocked captions or narratives where you say where you were at that in the context of the book, which I find really interesting, that technique. So
I debated with myself over how to give some insight that I had. This is a book that I wanted to have presenting Montanans as they participated both in Montana and around the world in the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And so I debated with how I could, since I'd been on active duty almost 30 years of the 50-year Cold War period, I debated with myself on the best technique to do that. And I hit upon the periodically, as we'd go into different phases or different operations. I have a short description of what I was doing and how that connected with the world events that were taking place at the time, like in this case, the Cuban Missile Crisis. So Kennedy made the decision to quarantine Cuba. And by that, he was going to use the U.S. Navy to essentially stop any Soviet ships that were bringing more weapons, either aircraft associated or missile systems, into Cuba. And at the same time, so no more would come. At the same time, he'd apply maximum pressure to force the ships that did come to load the systems that were already there and take them back out of Cuba. And he announced it that evening by saying any ships of any kind bound for Cuba from whatever nation or port will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. This quarantine will be extended if needed to other types of cargo and carriers. And he did say, oh, by the way, we're not going to blockade, we're not going to impound food and other vital goods needed for the Soviet forces that are already in Cuba. We're not going to act like the Soviets did when they put the Berlin blockade in being, and we're going to enforce it for weapons, and that's it. So in the aftermath of that red line speech, Montana's military swung into action, and it actually had the benefit of some really good analysis and writing by Troy Halsell, the 341st Strategic Missile Wing historian at Malmstrom. And he wrote that Governor Tim Babcock activated the Montana National Guard since half of the state's counties didn't have civil defense preparations. The Guard also established a communications network, warning systems, and a radiological program for forecasting and detecting radioactive fallout. And at the same time, Malmstrom's fighters were dispersed to Billings Airport. So those were all preparations that were going on here in Montana in the midst of this Cuban Missile Crisis. Historian Halsell goes on to describe the environment at Malmstrom at the time, because as most of you know, I'm sure, the Minuteman intercontinental ballistic missiles, the first solid fuel missiles in the world, were being installed around Great Falls, centered on Malmstrom Air Force Base, but they hadn't been declared operational. The first flight, Alpha, was nearing operational status, and historian Halsell says this about that. Typically 16-hour days at Malmstrom were normal, weekends included. The payload was the missile squadrons and wing reaching operational readiness well ahead of schedule. In other words, during the missile crisis, before they were too late to be considered what they called themselves, the ace in the hole for President Kennedy. The unfolding events even took the ICBM construction crews by surprise. Quality assurance contractor Jack Gannon heard about the crisis while driving to Lewistown from Eddie's Corner. Upon arrival, he told his co-workers that they'd better get them wrapped up. We're going to be using them in about 20 minutes. So following President Kennedy's address, SAC Commander General Thomas Power instructed Colonel Andrus, the commander of the wing here in Great Falls, to determine if the wing could posture all 10 Minuteman ICBMs in its Alpha flight and find a way to launch them. Engineers designed the West weapon system to require launch commands from two different launch control centers. The problem was that the 341st only had one launch control center, and that's Alpha 1 constructed. Mm-hmm. Colonel Andrus had to kludge the system. His airmen did so by introducing the critical parts of a second launch control unit into the circuitry in Alpha 1's launch control center so that a double crew could turn the four keys simultaneously and thus launch the birds if needed. So on the 27th of October at 3:07 in the afternoon, the Minutemen were online, and on 5 day later, the first one was online, and 5 days later, all of Alpha Flight was on alert.
This is 1962, right?
This was in October 62.
Okay, and you're listening to KGPR 89.9 FM. I'm here with, this is Rich Liebert, here with Captain Ken Robeson, U.S. Navy retired, and Montana historian, talking about the Cold War and the impact, especially the October, we call the October Missile Crisis, Cuban Missile Crisis. If we had to go back to read the old papers and so forth, and its relevance today, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in a little bit about how it impacts today. So,
it's not easy today to fathom the depth, the day-to-day tension on both sides of this potentially catastrophic crisis as it unfolded. An episode occurred on the 27th of October, ironically the day that first Minuteman went online, and this was actually a near-fatal day, the closest single day that we ever came to a nuclear exchange, when an incident upon a Soviet submarine happened. The U.S. Navy destroyer USS Beale was part of that quarantine, and it acquired a submarine on sonar and dropped practice depth charges on the nuclear-armed Soviet Foxtrot-class submarine B-59. Operating near the quarantine line around Cuba. B-59 was one of four Foxtrots hastily deployed to Cuban waters and had been out of radio contact with Moscow for several days, knowing that the war was near and wondering if it had already begun. So the charges that were being dropped, those non-lethal warning shots, were intended to force B-59 to the surface. But the submarine's captain, Valentin Valesky, mistakenly took them for live explosives. Adding more fuel to the fire, a second U.S. Navy destroyer arrived on scene and began dropping unauthorized hand grenades with blasting sounds like sledgehammers. Convinced that he was engaged in the opening round of war, the B-59 captain angrily ordered his men to arm his submarine's single nuclear-tipped torpedo and prepare to attack. The misunderstanding could have resulted in disaster if not for a Soviet naval contingency measure that required all three of the submarine's senior officers to sign off before a nuclear launch. The Soviet captain ordered it, but Captain Valesy Azhipov, not normally part of the B-59 crew, but rather the chief of staff of the submarine brigade, who had just happened to have sailed as an observer on the Foxtrot, was on board the B-59, and Azhipov refused to give his consent. After calming the captain down, Azhipov coolly convinced his fellow officers to bring B-59 to the surface and request new orders from Moscow. The submarine eventually returned to Russia without incident, but it was more than 40 years later, after the end of the Cold War, when Soviet archives and their willingness to share information with the U.S. opened up and allowed us to learn about this amazing occurrence on board B-59, the Foxtrot.
It's a lot of human drama there.
It was really some drama.
It's like Crimson Tide, the movie on the Navy side, right?
And as former Secretary of State Dean Acheson wrote, in foreign affairs, brains, preparation, judgment, and power are of utmost importance, but luck is essential. And Captain Azhipov's presence on board B-59 was indeed luck. During the several days of intense negotiations, Kennedy and Khrushchev dramatically reached an agreement. Publicly, the Soviet Union would remove its offensive aircraft and missiles from Cuba in exchange for U.S. declaration not to invade Cuba. Secretly, the U.S. agreed to withdraw the Jupiters from Turkey. With the Soviet withdrawal from Cuba, the naval quarantine formally ended on November 20th. Through the course of the crisis, Khrushchev learned that President Kennedy was a formidable leader, and both men were shocked at how close they'd come to a nuclear exchange. A direct Moscow-Washington hotline was established to facilitate rapid communications, and the two leaders initiated a dialogue leading to a series of agreements to reduce U.S. and Soviet nuclear the tensions. By December 11th of 1962, the 341st Missile Wing had its second ICBM flight on alert, and by July 1963, all 150 Minutemen at Malmstrom were operational. The Minuteman's success during and after the Cuban Missile Crisis led Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara to authorize the full force of 1,000 Minuteman ICBMs. So that's the story behind the Cuban Missile Crisis. And ironically, for many, many years, we did not know about that Soviet Foxtrot submarine. Of course, it did come to the surface, and we had no idea at the time how close they had come to launching their nuclear-tipped torpedo, which, if it had been launched and taken out several U.S. Navy ships, we can only imagine what would have followed. And that kind of leads us to today, because the sort of a good period of the 1990s after the Soviet Union fell in 1991 and actually dissolved itself and freed the Warsaw Pact countries in Central and Eastern Europe and their own constituent republics. And all of those countries, and they all became separate independent countries, have had varying degrees of success with democracy, some of them not so successful, some of them very successful. But here we are today with a resurgent Soviet, not a Soviet Union, but a resurgent Russia with a leader who seems very anxious to reconstitute a Russian empire, not with the Communist Party in control, but rather his own dictatorial Russian forces
like
in
imperial
control.
Russia, right?
An imperial Russia with Tsar Putin as the leader. And that, of course, has been behind his war against Georgia and several of the other constituent republics that became independent in 1991. And it's certainly behind his 2022 major invasion of a free and independent Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So we're at the point in time where we're not only facing a resurgent imperial Russia, but we're facing an increasingly aggressive China in the Pacific, and
it's the great powers game. That's what they call it, right? The great
appears
powers
to be leading us into a dual Cold War with Russia on the European environment and Communist China in the Pacific.
Is this like Cold War 2.0, Ken?
It sure headed that way, and the longer and more extreme Putin and his invasion of the Ukraine proceeds, the more dangerous it gets, of course. And we've learned many things from that invasion of the Ukraine. We've learned the limitations of the Russian army. We've learned the disastrous supply system they seem to have, and so on. But we've also learned that even though they appeared divided at the time of the invasion, the Ukrainian people for almost totally have united and fought very bravely in the face of some really devastating casualties on both sides, on the Russian side and certainly on the Ukrainian side, and bolstered by strong military equipment and military support from European NATO members and the U.S. That war slogs on, and all the while, as long as it proceeds, we seem to be miring even further into a Cold War 2.0.
And you served in Sweden as a naval attaché, right?
I did.
And now Sweden and Finland, are they officially in NATO now, or
no,
are they still waiting?
They're not yet in NATO because of Turkey's difficulty in the way Sweden mostly, but to some extent Finland also, has supported the Kurd separatist movement in the past. And but when I was in Sweden as a naval attaché in the 1970s, Sweden's peacetime program was non-alignment, and their wartime program was neutrality. And this had been since 1815, the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and there was no chance in that era that Sweden and Finland, either one, would ever take steps to join NATO. So the one thing that Tsar Putin has done has so thoroughly, I'd say, shaken up those two Baltic neighbors of Russia with the invasion of the Ukraine and his imperial march, that they have come out strongly in sentiment in the country, and their leadership is leading them into NATO. And as soon as they work out their difficulties with Turkey, those two will be full-fledged members of NATO. In the meantime, the NATO leadership and the U.S. has assured them that they are considered part of NATO for defense purposes, and the Soviet Union better treat them as parts of NATO.
And Sweden and Finland are certainly very capable military entities.
They learned in, over the years, and during World War II, Finland had that terrible double experience of first an invasion by the Soviet Union, and they defended themselves surprisingly well. And then they had, they had to join Germany to fend off the Soviet Union, and that cost them at the end of the war. So Finland knew from World War II, but so did Sweden too, because Sweden had seen what had happened to Norway, Denmark, and the other Scandinavian countries. And they see a resurgent Russia as being a real threat to Finland, Sweden, and the rest of Scandinavia. And they bring a very strong concept of total defense, where Sweden, in their case, they build their own submarines, they build their own aircraft. This is a country with the population the size of Los Angeles, about 10 million people.
Hard to believe.
Building fighter aircraft that are competitive with
that's
the
Saab,
best
right? Is it a Saab?
Saab, okay. Viggens and Drakens.
Oh, some of you folks out there, maybe you have an old Saab or something.
Or Volvos.
Right. And interesting, we talk about Ukrainians are very fiercely proud of their country and their background. One time when I was a RTC instructor, I had a young cadet, Danny Friend, and said, "I'm not Russian, Captain Liebert. I'm Ukrainian." And,
yeah,
and
even
very,
though
very
they were
passionate about it, he said, "Don't you ever call me a Russian, Captain?" Saying,
even though they were forced into into the Soviet Union, they were always Ukrainians,
right.
And they'd had probably the worst time of any single country in World War II. The devastation, the numbers killed, and so on.
And the Ukrainians also came to Montana too, the settlers, didn't they?
Yeah, they did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
and I talk about some of those in the book.
That, right.
So Cold War Montana does cover the Cuban Missile Crisis, but it's just one really important episode in that whole story.
All the way from the end of World War II with the secrets going out in the bag to Russia and all the way up through Gorbachev, Glasnost, and all that. And I remember one thing, you were on a carrier during Desert One, right? During the
I was on the Nimitz,
and I was in Germany as a young lieutenant. We rolled out on alert too. He said, "Well, something's going on over there."
Well, we launched the eight Chinook helicopters. It was the first time all of those helicopters were able to take off at a single time. They'd had so many maintenance problems, and they did take off, but then they started dropping like flies along the way, and that tragic attempt to rescue the hostages from Tehran failed, and that's another major episode in the Cold War, and I was right on the scene on that in the Indian Ocean with the USS Nimitz and the launch of the...
Yeah, that was a devastating loss, American, you know, military, devastating. So these moments are all captured in Ken's book, Cold War Montana, on sale throughout Montana and Cassiopeia Books downtown and Barnes & Noble too, right?
Absolutely.
And other places you've done more book signings coming up?
Oh, I always have book signings.
I know you...
I'll be at both Cassiopeia and Barnes & Noble before Christmas, and also at Leslie's Hallmark in the mall. They're great about carrying my books, and I always have a signing or two before Christmas there as well.
And I'm sure you'll have some good stories about Montanans and the Cold War for Veterans Day talk, right?
You bet.
I mean, how and you said how it relates. Everybody, you know, everybody's connected to it. You know, in my deed on my ranch, I've got a United States government missile path. Where they dug a trench, and then, you know, they're going to be upgrading all those. And Colonel Little, Barry Little, a new Commander Malmstrom, he might be talking about the Sentinel program. What's it, the ground-based deterrent program? I think GBSD or Northrop Grumman's out there doing work on that. So
yeah, and in my book, I also talk about, have a photo of the mammoth building east of Conrad that was part of what was going to be an anti-ballistic missile program that was coming into Montana, and that's a topic for another day.
Right.
But what a program that would have been. The Air Force fought it all the way because it was Army run. They wanted more Minuteman missiles rather than an anti-ballistic missile system, and we'll save that story for another day.
Okay. Did some musician play in that facility? one of our friends, Megan Carl's, a wonderful gal from the Great Falls Symphony. I think she's played in some of these old facilities.
Well, she's going around right now to the missions, like St. Peter's Mission and St. Mary's and so on with her compositions. And I think our great Montana treasure musician, Phil Auberg's music that he's writing for Megan to perform.
Well, that's wonderful. This is all the stream of things we're doing here on Local Public Radio, promoting heritage and our culture and everything else we do. And we thank you for being in the studio today, Ken. And just to remind everybody, Veterans Day is always 11-11-11, the 11th hour, the 11th day, the 11th month, when the armistice was enacted in 1918. And that also touches on your two great World War I volumes, the one showing Montana preparing, then the one Montana at War. I think that's the second title, right?
Yeah, Montana's in the Great War.
Montana's in the Great War, and Montana had made a great contribution, and the impacts are far-reaching. We don't see them every day, just like the impacts in Cold War Montana. So we welcome everybody to Veterans Day at the Montana Veterans Memorial, montanaveteransmemorial.org, and we're going to be covering that ceremony live with Eric Peterson and Matt Donnelly. We'll be working with Gabe to get that on the air, and we're going to have a great time and remember our traditions. And if we're not at the memorial site, we'll be in the lobby of Centene Stadium. We've been in there before, but we always honor Veterans Day and Memorial Day. No matter what, pandemics, weather, we're always there, Ken.
You bet.
All right. Thanks, Ken Robeson. And we'll see you in a couple weeks for On Point Veterans Talk Radio. Thank you, everybody.